think so. Well, good morning, everybody. Actually, can somebody shut those lights off? You put them off a minute. Yeah, okay. Just, you won't see me, but you'll see the screen, which is better than me. As Sel said, my name is Barry DeBolin, and I know many of you, or some of you personally, and others to having seen you around town when I was a member of parliament here from 2004 until 2015. When I announced in 2014 that I wasn't running again, I got two kinds of reactions from people. To people who had only known me politically, so people who had kind of met me in politics or when I was the MP, they were surprised that I was leaving and that I was choosing to leave. However, up in Halliburton, to my oldest friends, a couple of guys that I went to elementary school with, they laughed and said, Barry, we can't believe you stayed that long. So, and what they know is that I have a variety of interests. Politics, public life is one of them. But I have other things that I'm interested in my life. And I've said, I love apples, but I don't want to eat apples only for the rest of my life. I'd like to try a pineapple, and I'd like to try a banana and some different things. And so it's the same for work. I enjoyed the time that I spent in Ottawa and here in the riding as a member of parliament. But I wanted to do some other things. And so to give you some context of how I ended up in Korea, back in the 1990s, my wife and I were living in Toronto. I was working in the provincial government at that time for Chris Hodson, who was our member of provincial parliament and a minister at that time. And my wife and I had this conversation, kind of, what do we want to do in our life? Do we want to have some adventures, kind of before we have kids? And we decided we wanted to live overseas, and we went through a process and ended up going to South Korea. And we were there for a year and a half teaching English. This is back in 1996, 97. Came back, kind of forgot about Korea a little bit, got back involved with work. I was a consultant, had a communications company, and then became member of parliament in 2004. In 2006, the government was looking for individual MPs who would be willing to kind of get involved in a bilateral relationship with another country. And in some cases, if you're an MP, I don't know, in Woodbridge or somewhere like that, and you have a lot of Italian-Canadian constituents, you'd have an interest in kind of getting kind of connected to the Italian community, both in Italy and, you know, here in Canada. As you know, in our riding, we don't have a lot of recent immigrants in this area. It's not as kind of diverse in terms of the ethnicity here. But I was interested to volunteer. I said, well, I would like to do this, and I'll help out. And when they showed me the list of different groups or countries that they wanted to connect with, Korea was on there. And I said, well, I don't have a whole lot of Koreans in my riding, but I have lived there. I like Korea. I like Koreans. And so there weren't a bunch of people fighting over that file. And so I became the government liaison to the Korean community. So, which was a job that nobody had had before, and I kind of sat in Ottawa thinking, well, what do I do now? Because I knew I was needed to kind of work with the Korean-Canadian community, which is largely in the Toronto and Vancouver areas, but spread out in other places as well, but also to get involved with the bilateral relationship between Canada and South Korea. And at that time, we were still negotiating a free trade agreement with them. So I thought, well, maybe the first thing I should do is call the ambassador here in Ottawa, the South Korean ambassador, which I did. Became friends. We are actually still friends, and I'm going to see him. I'm going to be back in Korea in about a month, and I'll see him while I'm there. He's retired now. So that's my connection with Korea. Jumping forward to 2013, 2014, when I knew I didn't want to run again and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next, my wife and I had the same conversation. We thought, well, we're going to move back to Halliburton eventually. The question is, we had been living in Ottawa. Our kids had been going to school there. Do we want to do something kind of in between? And we looked at different opportunities. And I was in Korea with a Team Canada mission at that time, having dinner with my friend, former Ambassador Yim. And he said, why don't you come back to Korea? He said, all of our universities here are trying to attract more foreign students. In order to do that, they have to teach in English. I mean, some student, from China or Malaysia or South America that wants to come and study here, they're not going to learn Korean. So the universities in Korea have become functionally bilingual institutions, kind of half, two-thirds in Korean, one-third in English. And he said, the fact that you know something about Korea, you've lived here before, because my wife and I were there for a year and a half, He said, I think that you would do a great job teaching politics, public administration. Anyway, he went through and helped me look at different jobs. To give you an idea of scale, in the Seoul area, there are 42 universities. That's to serve the 25 million people that live there, okay? So it's a big city, and I ended up being offered jobs actually from three universities and picked one. And so in my last year here, as I was finishing in the summer of 2015, about 4 years ago, I had already lined up a job, a two-year contract in Korea. Their school calendar is the opposite of ours. It starts actually in January or in March and kind of ends at the end of the year. So the contract started March 1st, 2016. So I knew we were going to be living in Korea for 2 years. I had been overseeing the university. My wife and I went over. We saw the apartment we were going to live in, which was provided by the university. We were kind of set to go. My kids were not sure it was a good idea, but they were young enough. They had to do what we told them, which is why I didn't want to wait until now, 4 years later, because I would have lost that argument now, right? So when they're 17 and 15 now. They were 13 and 11 then. So anyway, we were going to move to Korea, and we actually ended up with, there was a six-month gap, because basically I was finishing now kind of in September as the MP, and my job didn't start until March 1st. So we basically bought four backpacks, put everything we owned in storage, and we took a six-month trip around the world. We went through Europe, Africa, the Middle East, Australia, through Asia, ending up in Korea at the end of February so that I could start work on March 1st. We were there for 2 years. Never planned to stay forever, but we're kind of open-minded to maybe extending it by a year or two. And this is the story I was telling Sal. What I did not foresee as we got into the second year and we were talking about should I extend it by a year or not, was that my son wanted to come home. He's, Dad, I want to go to high school. I want to play football. I want to ski. I want to get my license, hunt and fish, you know, to be a Halliburton boy. And my daughter desperately did not want to leave Korea. She loved Seoul. She loved the big city. She was going to a school there. And so I never foresaw that at the end of this process, I'd have, it didn't matter what I decided, I was going to have one happy kid and one unhappy kid. Anyway, we came home. So we moved back last winter. So I got back here about March 1st. So I've been home, I guess, about a year and a half now. And before, the summer before that, we were home for a little holiday, and I went out for lunch with Jamie Schmale, now the member, previously ran my office, and his wife Julia, who runs Denure Tours. And I said to Julia, when I come home, I want to start a travel company. I've traveled a lot. I want to take people. I want to show people the way I travel. And we had this conversation, and she said, why don't you come and work for us part-time at Denure? She said, we want to do hiking trips. We need some people, a tour director that can actually manage some of these hiking groups. So fast forward through that, when I came home a year or so ago, I did two things. I started my own travel company called Travel Maven, specialized in kind of small groups, 10 to 15 people, going often to a big city, lots of walking, kind of what I'd call a middle-level three-star tour. The key positives, I would say, is small group and lots of walking. So those are the two key elements in the tours. I have started, did some in the spring. And my next one is actually to South Korea that leaves right after. I leave 2 days after Thanksgiving to take a group to Korea for 2 weeks. I have them going to South Africa this winter and a bunch of different places over the next year. So that's what I'm doing. I'm also still working for Denure's. And in fact, the reason I had to come to Lindsay today anyway was to do some preparation. Tomorrow morning I leave with a group for Nashville. So I do some hiking for Denure's, and I do what I'd call regular tours. So this one is to Nashville. I'm doing one to Egwa Canyon later this month. In the summer, I did hiking trips to Quebec and Newfoundland for them. So that's kind of what I'm doing now. But I was asked by an organization in Halliburton a few months ago if I could come and explain what's going on in Korea. And I had kind of put together a presentation. I actually taught a course on this. When I was in Korea, I was teaching politics, but to other foreigners, right? It wasn't to Koreans. So I was actually teaching Korean politics in Korea, which is kind of ironic. But I used to say that I thought for the other foreign students, actually it was, if you're a student coming from India to Korea, in some ways I think learning from a Canadian, because I can explain what it looks like from the outside, that a Korean professor probably wouldn't have the same perspective, right? So I did that. So this is actually based on a course that I taught at the university for a year based on Korean politics. So everybody's heard of Korea. And as I look around this room, there's probably a few of you that can remember the Korean War, or when you were kids, that there was the Korean War was on. Certainly the Cold War was on. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to go back about 120 years and fairly quickly walk you through to where we are today. This is basically like a background presentation. How did we get where we are today in Korea? In my experience, most Canadians have a fairly vague sense of Korea. People mix up Korea and Vietnam all the time. Seems odd, but when you think about it, I think it's because there were two wars there and there's been lots of movies made about each, right? So people would say, oh, you're in Korea, it's really tropical there. I'd say, no. Don't you remember on MASH? It was cold in the wintertime, right? It's like, oh, yeah. So the sense of Korea is kind of vague. It kind of sits in Asia. We know geopolitically North Korea, nuclear weapons, and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of how we got there, really to understand what's going on in Korea today, you need to understand what went on in the late 19th century and throughout the 20th century, especially the key period between 1945 and 1953. So here's Korea. So this is Asia. This is Korea. This is North Korea, what's called South Korea, Japan on one side, China here, Russia here. So in Canada, sometimes we complain about living next door to a superpower that pushes us around sometimes. How do you think the Koreans feel, right? I used to tell people in Korea, I used to say the people who could really appreciate your situation would be the Polish people. Because Poland, sitting between Germany and Russia, they're getting kicked around in the French for centuries, they would understand how you kind of feel being stuck in here. It's a peninsula. The border runs along here. The vast majority of the border is with China, but there actually is a little sliver there that it connects to Russia. These are big, powerful, and here's Vietnam way down here. These are big, powerful countries over the last, you know, millennia of history. And so Korea has been kind of the little guy fighting to protect itself and to remain independent for a long, long time. This is nothing new to Koreans. Korea has a population of about 75 million, about a third of them in the northern half and about two-thirds of them in the southern half. 221,000 square kilometers. Sometimes I describe Korea as kind of like Florida with mountains and a lot more people, okay? So it is about 70% mountainous. It has almost no natural resources other than land that's arable in different places, but there's no minerals, there's no oil. Historically, I wouldn't say it was really poor, but historically has never been really wealthy. And Korea has been Korea for a long time. That's another thing that's important. Unlike Europe, where, you know, we talk about Germany, but Germany has only existed since 1871. Before, there was Prussia and Bavaria and different pieces that came together. Korea has been Korea for most of the past 5,000 years. There were times when there were smaller kingdoms, but they have been smaller Korean kingdoms, not anything else. One language, one ethnic group on the peninsula. And going back to my Florida analogy, when people ask me about kind of where is Seoul and Busan, which are the two cities, I say Seoul is kind of like where Tampa is, and Busan is kind of where Miami is, okay? And Pyongyang, which is the capital of the north, is kind of like Tallahassee, okay? Like if you wanted to kind of position them, I know many of us have a strong Florida map in our head. But this is Seoul right here, 25 million people in that area, and this is Busan, about 5 million people in the second city. The first time Ursula and I lived in Korea, we lived in Busan. And the second time we lived in Seoul. One thing I said a few minutes ago is that most of the northern border is with China, but there is a small piece, 17 kilometers long, that is with Russia. And this is absolutely key historically, that there are times when things can go back and forth between Korea and Russia without going through China. So that short stretch of border has been very important over the years. And there's actually a rail line. So Vladivostok is, I can't see it, it's up here somewhere, which is the Siberian port city, but the train runs down through. And so even today, if the president of North Korea wanted to go to Vladivostok, which he did in the last, he can go by train without going through China. Maybe I'll go back. So I said, Korea has been Korea for a long time. There's a mountain here. It's an extinct volcano, Mount Baektu, which is kind of the sacred mountain to Koreans. And there's two rivers. One river flows this way, and one river flows this way. And so the border between Korea and China is clear. And again, there's lots of places in the world, you think, in Europe, between Germany and France, how that border has moved back and forth so many times throughout history. This is a land border, but because of the river, it has defined that border for a long time. In the 19th century, the 1870s, 80s, 90s, Korea was a kingdom. They had a king. It was kind of not poor, but certainly not wealthy. They historically have had lots of battles with Japan. Japan has gone into Korea and taken it over and kind of ransacked the place from time to time over 5,000 years. In the late 19th century, Japan was getting stronger and stronger, and Korea was getting weaker and weaker. And so Japan started to develop relationships with the king, with the political leadership in Korea, and essentially started taking over. In the 1890s, Japan was having more and more influence over Korea. And by 1910, Japan was in full expansionary mode at that time. They were grabbing parts of Manchuria and China. They were grabbing other countries to create their own colonies. And they took Korea in 1910. So from 1910 until 1945, Korea was a Japanese colony. And the Japanese were horrific colonial masters. They built railways and steel yards and industrially and things like that. They developed a lot of Korea, but they essentially tried to stamp out the indigenous population. Korean children were not allowed to speak Korean. They were given Japanese names. That Japan basically was trying to make Korea just an extension of Japan. This went on from 1910 until 1945. So Korea really wasn't involved in the Second World War, only as a feeder to the Japanese army, both men working in factories, producing steel, things like that. Women, you may have heard of the issue of comfort women, which essentially the Japanese army ran brothels, and the women were brought in from their colonies. So young women from Indonesia, from China, from Korea, were brought in to basically serve in these brothels for Japanese soldiers. And Japan's never really properly apologized for that, which is still an issue between these two countries today. So all of a sudden, it's 1945, the atomic bomb drops on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, World War II has ended. During World War II, of course, the Americans and the Soviets were allies fighting against the Nazis in Germany and the Japanese. In July of that year, World War II ends in Europe first. So the Soviet army was almost 100% in Europe, right? The Americans, of course, were in Europe, but they were also active in Asia. And what was becoming very clear by 1944, 1945, is that while the Soviets and the Americans agreed that they wanted to defeat the Nazis and the Japanese, they agreed on almost nothing else, and it would be within a heartbeat of the end of World War II, those two allies would split and would instantly become adversaries of each other. And so, you know, the Cold War really started immediately in 1945. You'll recall that Germany was partitioned. So there was this whole thing at the end of World War II, who will get to Berlin first, the Soviets or the Allies, you know, the British, Canadians, and Americans. Subsequently, Germany was divided up into four administrative areas that the Soviets controlled one, the Americans one, the British one, the French one, with the idea that it's temporary and eventually we'll reestablish a government in Germany. The problem was, the Soviets said, we want a communist-style one-party state government. And the other three said, we don't agree. They went back and forth. And eventually the French, the British, and the Americans said, you know what, this is going nowhere. We're going to put our three pieces together and set up an independent country called the Bundesrepublik Germany, which we call West Germany. And the fourth quarter, became East Germany. So if you ever look at one of those old maps, that's why East Germany was one quarter of, you know, West Germany was three times bigger, because it was three quarters and one quarter. They used the same logic in Vietnam at one point after in the early 1950s to divide it in the middle, that the Soviets would kind of, or the Chinese would kind of administrate half and the Americans would administrate the other half until they could figure out how to make it work as a single national government. What's kind of interesting is that if you look at what they did in, what the Allies did in Europe, which is dividing up their former enemy, they did not do that in Asia, because the analogy would have been Japan would have been divided, right? Japan was the country they were fighting against, not Korea. But the Americans were there and the Soviets weren't. And so the Americans just essentially took Japan, right? And by the time there were no Russians around to compete, they took it over. But the Soviets, I call them Russians, but the Soviets at that time, they also wanted a peace in Asia. They wanted some of the islands off the north side of Japan. But they also thought, we'll grab Korea. And so Stalin, in 1945, in the summer of 1945, were sending train loads of troops east across Russia into Siberia, and they started pouring into Korea right in 1945. By this point, the Americans already knew that there was going to be this kind of battle of the titans between the kind of the capitalists and the communists, and they did not want to lose all of Korea. And so the Americans, but at the same time, the Americans were busy. They were trying to look after Japan. They were trying to deal with the Philippines. They were dealing with China. They were dealing in Europe. So the Americans had like 20 hotspots around the world that they were trying to look after, Korea being not one of the priorities at all. And the Soviets obviously were doing what they were doing in Eastern Europe. But in terms of in Asia, Korea was the one that they thought, well, we can grab that one because we can get there by train. And it's connected to us. And the Americans are busy elsewhere. So the Americans put forward a proposal saying, like in Germany, why don't we agree to temporarily divide South Korea in two parts? And the Soviets, you guys, will administrate the northern part, and the Americans will administrate the southern part until we figure out how to put Korea back together again, right? So a couple of mid-level American soldiers, officers, were given the job of to figure out where to draw a line. They got a map out. They looked at the country. They wanted to be somewhere in the middle, and they definitely wanted Seoul on their side of the line. And they noticed that the 38th parallel ran right through basically the area where they wanted to be. So the Americans proposed, we'll just use the 38th parallel. This is mountainous terrain, right? So this line on the ground makes no sense at all. But to people sitting thousands of miles away with a map and a ruler and a pencil, that was how the 38th parallel became the temporary division. And to the surprise of the Americans, the Soviets agreed, because the Americans, if the Soviets say no, there's actually not much we can do, right? They're already coming in here. They're just going to push to the south very quickly. So the Americans were actually happy to get half. And immediately what happened was the Americans found their guy and the Soviets found their guy, right? And so both sides says, well, we can solve this Korean problem. We got a guy here. He can be the president. Take it over and put it together. Everything will be good in Korea. We can stop arguing about it. And the Soviets said, well, that's a great idea, but not your guy. Our guy. He should be in charge, right? And he'll set it up as a good socialist republic that'll help all the people. So Syngman Rhee was the name of the person put forward in South Korea. He had never been elected by anybody, right? So this isn't like an old government that's being reestablished. See, some of the countries in 1945 could say, well, we were our own country until 1939 or 1940, just kind of put us back the way we were before. Like Poland could have said that, right? Or Holland or somewhere like that. But in Korea, they'd been a colony since 1910. There was no old government, right? That was like 35 years ago. So Syngman Rhee, he's our guy. The Soviets said, no, we have this guy, Kim Il-sung. He led the battle to try to kick the Japanese out. He's like the Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, or the, Tito in Yugoslavia, or kind of the Castro in Cuba, kind of the local rebel that leads the peasants in a revolt to kick the colonial masters out, kind of a national hero. So he said, he's our guy. Well, of course, the Americans didn't agree with the Soviets, and the Soviets didn't agree with the Americans. So there's kind of a stalemate, 1945, 1946, 1947. People are kind of streaming back and forth. I always say, imagine this is Saskatchewan and this is Alberta, and so like all the conservatives in Saskatchewan are rushing down here, and all the NDPers here are rushing up there, right, to kind of get to the area where kind of their people are in charge. So there was no wall at that point. People could move freely back and forth, but there was a great dislocation of people, right? And people that were more pro-American wanted to be down here in the American zone. And pro-Soviet Union at that time went up here. You also have to remember that in Korea, the Americans almost immediately, they were looking after Japan, and Japan became kind of the ally quickly of the Americans. So the Koreans are like, hang on a minute, like, to lots of Koreans, the notion that they would become affiliated with this country, the United States, that immediately had already become kind of an ally with their arch enemy. So part of it would have been ideological, are you left wing or right wing? But part of it would have been anti-Japanese, right? Which is that if you Americans are friends with the Japanese, then you're not friends with us, right? Remember, they got 5,000 years of squabbling back and forth. And for the Koreans, they just had 35 years of brutal colonial rule from the Japanese. So there was a great amount of flow of people back and forth, kind of chaos. And again, in the world was worried about what's going on in Europe, what's going on in Japan, what's going on in all these other places. Korea was a backwater that very few people talked about. At this time, both sides, the Soviets and the Americans, said, well, we're just going to go ahead and set up a government, right? So on the south, the Americans set up a government. They called it the Republic of Korea and wrote a constitution. It was going to be democratic. It was going to be capitalist. And it claimed the whole peninsula. There was no notion that these were two countries. This was just a temporary administrative division. So until today, the constitution of the Republic of Korea claims the entire peninsula and all the people. And it's like a mere reflection going on in the north. Exactly the same thing happened in the north. The Soviets wrote a constitution, a socialist state based on Marxist principles, and it claimed the whole peninsula, and that the other half was being temporarily occupied by somebody, a colonial power, the Americans. And these guys said, no, this is temporarily occupied by a colonial power, the Soviets. So there was great disagreement, and there was no resolution in sight. As we move into the late 1940s, sorry, I should mention too, that historically, the northern half of Korea was a bit wealthier than the southern half. There are a few natural resources here. There was more industry here. Kind of like Italy, where the northern half historically is wealthier, more industrial than the southern half. So that's similar in Korea. Also, Kim Il-sung, who was the president of North Korea, grandfather of the current president, he was a very brilliant politician. So he had one big brother up here, the Soviet Union. He said, send me tanks, send me trucks, send me stuff to rebuild my country. China had been involved in a civil war until 1949, but by 1949, the communists won, right? Mao Zedong won in China. So now, if you're the president of North Korea, you have two like big brothers that kind of don't like each other, both wanting you to be their patron. They both want to be your patron, okay? And Kim Il-sung was brilliant in terms of working one. Well, he says he'll give me tanks. If you don't want to give me tanks, he'll give me tanks. Or, oh, okay, I'll give you the tanks, right? So North Korea rearmed, rebuilt. And by 1950, North Korea was on its feet. And South Korea was still devastated because the Americans had done very little there, right? So North Korea, I'm just making this number up, but I'm going to say it was like five times more powerful in terms of their military, in terms of everything in South Korea. There was nowhere near an even balance. And they're still going back and forth, how are we going to solve this problem? By 1949, Kim Il-sung goes to Moscow and says to Stalin, I can solve this problem fast, right? We'll just take it over. Right? Let's stop talking. I got the army. We're ready to go. They have no army in the south. The Americans are busy with a bunch of other stuff in Europe. They will talk a lot, but they ultimately aren't going to send troops to Korea. So he begged for about a year and a half for Stalin to give him the green light that he could attack. Stalin said no, no, no for a long time until early 1950, when Stalin said, okay, let's deal with this. So June 25th, 1950, the North Korean army attacks and starts rolling south. And they roll south very quickly, meeting very little resistance. And it's quite clear that they're going to win, right? So the North Koreans, this is the line, they're coming down through Busan. Remember I was saying it's the second, there was Miami down here. So they push down. So now what's going to happen? Well, this is 1950. So you have this new thing called the United Nations that was formed in 1948 that's supposed to make sure that stuff like this doesn't happen. The Americans say, well, we're not going to solve it, but that maybe this new United Nations, all the countries of the world can go in to kind of defend the rights of the people living in the southern part of Korea. At the UN, the five kind of superpowers had veto power. The permanent members of the Security Council are still the same today. United States, France, Great Britain, China, and Soviet Union, Russia, right? So, but what was going on at the time was when they set up the Security Council, when they set up the United Nations, China got one seat, and they gave it to Taiwan, not to the main part of China, okay, because they're thinking, well, that Mao Zedong guy, he'll go away, and we'll restore order over there. And the Soviets were protesting that. The Soviets were protesting that the Chinese seat had been given to Taiwan, not to mainland China, not to Red China. And you could argue they had a pretty good case. They were boycotting the Security Council to protest China not being there. So all of a sudden, you have a motion to go and help the people of South Korea, which either the Chinese or the Soviets would have disagreed with and killed, but they weren't there because one didn't have the seat and the other one was boycotting it because the first one didn't have the seat, right? So that was how the first United Nations peacekeeping mission in 1950 was authorized. Now, amongst us in this room, we need to realize that the United Nations peacekeeping mission was more than 90% American. There were 17 countries there, but the other 16 countries contributed about 10% of the material and the manpower. You've got to remember, the Americans have huge bases still today in Japan and elsewhere. So they were in the neighborhood and could quickly mobilize. So they quickly came into Busan. Douglas MacArthur, right, the famous American general who was in charge of Japan, kind of took over, and they held Busan. There's lots of historians that believe that if the United Nations had taken a few weeks longer to sort it out, it would have been over. And there'd be military tactical historians who would argue if the North Koreans had been smarter and had really hit the gas pedal at the end and forced their way into Busan, they probably could have taken it before the UN got there, and it all would have been over before it started, right? But they didn't. They slowed down a little bit to try to figure out what they were going to do next. At that time, the Americans, the United Nations came in. So they start pushing in here. They start pushing north. Douglas MacArthur has his famous Incheon landing where he comes in. And Incheon is the port city for Seoul. Quickly, the United Nations starts pushing the North Korean. North Korea could kick the crap out of South Korea. But now, all of a sudden, you have these superpowers moving in with tons of equipment. And very quickly, it moves totally in the other direction. So as this line moves north from here, when it gets to about here, to the middle, of course, the interesting question is, do you stop when you get to the 38th parallel? Do you just kind of kick them out of your land and say, buzz off, don't come back? Or do you say, you know, this kind of sounds like George Patton's line, well, we're here, we got the boys, let's finish the job, right? So that was MacArthur's view. The American president, Truman, did not agree, but they didn't have instant communication, and Truman was enormously powerful in Asia at that time. And there's lots of historical evidence that Truman actually said, I want you to stop here. And by the time he got the response from MacArthur, was like, oh, well, you I know you said, I didn't get it till yesterday, and we've already gone all over the line, right? Sorry. We you know, it's like the old, I can't hear you on the phone when you don't want to hear them. So they didn't stop. They kept going. They pushed them forward. And so then the question is, now what do we do? Do we stop at the Korean border Or do we actually go into China because they think, well, eventually we've got to kick those communists out of there too? Do we keep going up into the Soviet Union? Probably would have been less of an option because of where it's so far from everything else. But by the time they got to about here, the decision got made for them, because one day the United Nations troops, including Canadians, woke up, and over the hill literally came millions of soldiers, Chinese soldiers. So China wasn't even involved. Remember, this whole first part, this was the Soviet Union, big brother. China was busy with their own stuff until 1949. Well, 1950, 1951, the Chinese Civil War has just ended. They have millions of battle-hardened, experienced troops. They got lots of equipment. They're the winners. So they are ready to roll, and they do. And they're willing to spend people, right? Like, if we lose 10,000 men, that's our strategy, right? It's just to overwhelm them. So very quickly, this line moves south. And now the Soviet Union has kind of backed out of it a little bit. They're still there with material. The North Koreans have been hit pretty hard by the United Nations forces, but now it's really the Chinese against the Americans is really what this part of the war is all about. And they push back down, and they end up bogged down, ironically, pretty close to the 38th parallel, right? So now we're into 1951, 1952. This is when MASH, in MASH it's kind of like, they're kind of set up in one place, and then they have to bug out for a few months and go somewhere, and then they get to come back. It's all, you can actually go to the place. I used to ride my bike up the river where we lived, and there was this town on the map called Weijambu. And I was like, Weijambu, I've heard of that somewhere, but part of that in MASH. That's the town they lived in MASH. It was called Weijambu. So now it's a suburb of Seoul. And so by 1953, they're here, bogged down. And they agree, let's time out, let's stop and talk about this and try to figure out how we can resolve it, both sides. So they agree. So they stop, July 27th, 1953, and at that moment, this is the line, the front, right? And that line follows the local topography, right, around the mountains and the rivers and stuff. So they said, okay, everybody stop. They actually took wooden stakes, almost like surveyor stakes, wooden stakes with painted white on the top, drove them in the ground to mark the line, and both sides agreed to back up 2 kilometers so that they wouldn't be right in each other's faces, that both sides would back up 2 kilometers and wait for a couple of weeks until we got this sorted out, right? So they each backed up 2 kilometers, and somebody quickly called that the demilitarized zone, because that was an area where the military from both sides were not allowed. And then it dragged on and it dragged on. And then fences got built along that line. So that if you go to Korea still today, the real fence for South Korea is here. Then there's 2 kilometers to the demarcation line of the war. And then 2 kilometers. And then there's another big fence on that side, which is the North Korean fence. And that 4 kilometers still exists today. It's called the demilitarized zone. It has actually become a nature sanctuary for animals and stuff in there now. It's heavily mined. Both sides, even though they weren't supposed to, have laid landmines. And so an American soldier told me when we were there that the landmines need 60 pounds to trigger. So he said there are wild pigs and small deer. He said there are no pigs or deer more than 60 pounds. He said, because every once in a while, not so much now, but he said years ago, every once in a while you'd hear a bang. Yeah, well, there goes a wild pig, right? So Darwinism about natural selection is happening fast in this area, that the pigs and the... But there's lots of birds and small animals and stuff there. The naturalists in South Korea say if we ever solve this problem, that should be kept as a park because it's the only real large natural space in Korea that's left. Anyway... But they also said, we need a place to talk. So this 4 kilometer zone across the country, they picked a place where they would narrow it right down to zero, just to the line. And they thought, so we'll have a place to talk. And there was a little village in a place called Panmunjeon, which is kind of north of Seoul, right here. And that was chosen as the place where they would hold talks, right? So... this is Panmunjeon today. So they moved, they look like ATCO trailers or portables from the school. That's exactly what they are. They're temporary buildings. So the border runs, if you can see that line right there, it's like a curb, basically. That's the border. So these buildings all sit kind of lengthwise on the border. So this end, this is from the north. So this is South Korea, that's their building. This is from the south back towards the north. This is a North Korean building. These are North Korean soldiers, these are South Korean soldiers. And they've been standing there like this with loaded guns half pointed at each other for 70 years. It's unbelievable that the thing has never exploded. It's truly unbelievable. These are young men, like in their 20s on both sides, with live ammunition. Sometimes, like, as close as from me to you, from the guy on the other side, right? If they walk right up to that line, that curb, that's the border right there. So there's only one place in the country that this exists, Panmunjom. You can actually go there as a tourist. When I take my tour group there next month, we will go and spend a day. We'll stand right on the steps of this building looking at this. And these buildings, there's a table inside, like one of these tables, a bit bigger, that's on the border, and there's three seats on that side, on the South Korean side, and there's a line down the middle of the table, and there's three seats on this side, and there's a flag on this side, which is the Republic of Korea, and there's a flag on this side, which is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea. And that's still there. This is the Cold War. This is a temporary solution from 1953 to a Cold War problem. It's like frozen in time. Absolutely frozen in time. Remember last year, a North Korean soldier kind of ran across. So if you're a North Korean soldier, way greater chance you'd have to shoot one of your fellow soldiers trying to sneak south than somebody trying to come north. But you have to remember, in the 1960s and even into the 1970s, North Korea was significantly wealthier than South Korea. South Korea didn't pass North Korea in terms of wealth until the 1970s. In 1970, South Korea was a fourth world country. In 1970, South Korea had a lower GDP per capita than Haiti or Bangladesh. Desperately poor, right? So, meanwhile, the North had the Soviets selling them oil cheap, and the Chinese, like, they had kind of like two big brothers supporting them, whereas the South Koreans had won the Americans, but the Americans were never as generous and had a lot more things at play in different places. So, somebody wrote a book back in the 1990s that said, "History is over." He was wrong, okay? History continues. This is last year. So this is the South Korean president, President Moon Jae-in, and this is the North Korean president, Kim Jong-un, who's the grandson of Kim Il-sung, who set up North Korea in the first place. So he's the third generation. And this was recently when they walked and actually met. This is the first, this has happened since the 1950s. We won't talk about Donald Trump very much. I'm not a fan. But I have argued for years with Korea that I think they need to talk. And you don't wait until the other side does what you want. Say, "Well, I'll only talk to you after you do what we want you to." That's basically both sides' positions. You do what we want, and then we'll talk to you. That's absolutely the Americans' position. North Korea, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, and then maybe we'll talk, right? So I agree with Donald Trump that they needed to meet and talk. Personally, I don't think Trump has a plan, but the notion to break the logjam to try to get some dialogue started, especially between these two, because I don't care who the American president is. They have 100 things on their mind, and Korea might be one of 100. If you're these guys, you wake up, you've lived your whole life. Right? This is since 1950. There aren't many people in Korea that can remember World War II or before World War II. So to any Korean, I don't know, 70 years and younger, this is all they know. They've known this their whole lives, right? And there's always this kind of existential threat in Korea that something's going to happen. They still have air raid warnings. I lived in South Korea recently, of course, during the time when Trump was kind of thumping his chest and Kim Jong-un was thumping his chest back. And one morning, we get earthquakes in that area. And one morning, our apartment shook a little bit. And I put on Facebook, I said, in Korea, when your apartment shakes, you hope it's an earthquake, right? So my mother did not think that was very funny. So, so this is still a live issue today. Nothing has been resolved. It's in the news again this morning. The North Koreans are testing missiles again. The Americans say, you shouldn't do that. And the North Koreans say, well, we're an independent country. You test missiles and stuff all the time. Like, who are you to tell us that we can't do it? So the story is not over. Some important points to remember. Korea has been Korea for thousands of years. It's one of the most ethnically and culturally homogeneous places on earth. So Korea has been Korea. There are no ethnic minorities in Korea. There's no second languages, like native second languages, right? So it's kind of the opposite of Canada. Canada is one of the most heterogeneous, the most diverse places on earth. Korea is kind of at the opposite end of the scale. Japan is similar, but there actually are ethnic minorities in Okinawa and different places in Japan. There are not in Korea, right? And historically, there was no such thing as North Korea and South Korea. And this is an important point. It's not like this is the way it used to be, and then they went together, and now they split up again. It was never split like this. Never, ever, ever. There's no natural logic as to why this place is split the way it is. The Korea was divided at the end of World War II, as I said, for administrative purposes. Here's the irony. Here's the profound irony. Virtually all Koreans, North and South, have always wanted a unified Korea. If you just go to Korea and say, put your hand up if you want a unified Korea, almost everybody puts their hand up. And they dream of it. It's kind of like next year in Jerusalem, except it's next year we'll be united, right? The challenge is they can't agree on the form of government or the way that the economy works or who would be the leader, right? So basically South Korea says, hey, we have a solution. Basically, you guys just collapse your country and we'll take over. And we'll be good. That's our version of unification. And, of course, the North Koreans say, well, the concept is good, but you've got it backwards, right? Which is, one side should collapse their government and their economy and just adopt the ways of the other. You just have it backwards. It's our ways that should be exported to the South, right? And today, when communism and this style of government is in retreat around the world, it seems pretty obvious, especially to younger people today, the notion that more countries would move in this direction. But, I mean, for those of us who can remember history over the preceding decades, especially in the 50s and 60s, if you've been kind of keeping score as to how well one side is doing at the other side, absolutely, during the 1950s and 60s and 70s, North Korea was on the move. North Korea was being rebuilt. North Korea had more prosperity, had better education, had better health care. People in South Korea were sneaking into North Korea. People in China were sneaking into North Korea, right? So that has all kind of turned around, right? But it hasn't always been like that. But they can't agree on how to structure the country. And essentially, both sides are saying the same thing, which is that if you would just give up and do it our way, we could solve this problem. It's unresolved. It's, as I say, here we are, 2019, and it's not resolved. Some other things to remember, there's no such thing as North Korea and South Korea. We use those words, but it's not really the names of either country. There's the Republic of Korea, ROK, with a multi-party political system and a market economy. That's AKA South Korea. And then there's the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, with a single-party political system, the Communist Party, and a command economy, right? So more like the Soviet Union would have been, because China is a bit crazy, right? Like China has kept the single party, but they've actually gone to more of a market economy. But in Korea, it's kind of the old-fashioned version, like Cuba would have been, or like the Soviet Union would have been, or like China or Vietnam would have been 20 years ago, right? When I taught in Korea, one of the things I told the students, when you look around the world, one thing you know for sure, any country that has the word democratic in its name is not. Okay? Hang on. So there were two Germanies. There was the Bundesrepublik Germany and there was the People's Republic of Germany. Which one's which? The Democratic Republic of Germany were kind of East Germans. The Democratic, that's the North. The constitutions of both countries claim they are the legitimate state and government for all Korean people and territory. So still today in 2019, the South Korean, the Republic of Korea claims the whole thing. That's why people who escape from the North, you can't get into the South. You cannot cross this border, right? They have to go into China and then take a boat and end up back in South Korea. We call them defectors because basically, if they show up in South Korea, they can say, well, I'm a citizen of the Republic of Korea because your constitution claims the whole place, including where I grew up. So, and you can imagine for the North Koreans to go over to the other side is treason. It's subject to execution, right? So if you escape from the North to the South, and I know lots of people who have done that, they cannot go back. If they go back, they'll be executed. You get executed for a lot of stuff in North Korea, less severe, less serious than treason. But both sides still claim the whole peninsula. Both sides claim all the people and all the territory. Pyongyang is poorer, and particularly in the rural areas, it is a lot poorer. But it's not. I think sometimes the stereotype, you know, they show some farmer pushing, you know, with a cow kind of pulling a plow. It's not that bad, but it is definitely poor. South Korea, I love it. I like big cities, and I'll tell you, Seoul. So it's a dynamic city. It's wealthy. It's essentially as wealthy as Canada. If you go to South Korea, especially the infrastructure from the airport to the highways to the subway system to the high-speed trains, it puts our infrastructure in Canada to shame, quite frankly. They have their own problems, don't get me wrong. But I'm just saying, in terms of modernity and stuff, this is the Lotte Tower. It's near where we used to live. So that is a building that is taller than the CN Tower. It's the fifth tallest building in the world. And this is, of course, a shopping mall and an amusement park attached to it. But South Korea today is a dynamic place, especially for young people, especially for young people in Asia. Seoul is the hot spot. I think in the 80s and the 90s it might have been Tokyo, but it's clearly not anymore. Seoul is now, if you're 22 years old with purple hair and a nose ring and you want to go and be yourself, you want to go to Seoul if you're from Vietnam or Malaysia or somewhere like that, right? Including many of the students I had. So that's Korea today. That's how we got here. I don't have the end to the story. If you could go back in time to 1953 after that armistice had been signed a month earlier and to say to people 66 years from now, nothing will have changed. They never would have believed it, right? They never would have believed that it could be that and essentially unstable, but survive that long. And it's a fascinating place to visit. A lot of Canadians, 516 Canadians, died during the Korean War. Many of them are buried in Busan in the UN cemetery. The South Korean government is still thankful, and each year there's a group of, they host veterans from around the world, including from Canada, to go to South Korea to kind of, to be shown the appreciation. And I've talked to some of these Canadian soldiers that hadn't been there since the 1950s. And trust me, it's one shock when they step off the airplane in Seoul. And I think they get a great sense of satisfaction because it's pretty clear if they hadn't shown up that they wouldn't be there today. So it's Canada played a significant role there and continues to be involved. So any questions? I'm gonna go. So the magic in South Korea is the people. Education is a very high value in Korean culture. The only other culture that I'm familiar with that places such an incredibly high value on education is the Jewish community, where education for generations is seen as the highest calling. When they do public opinion polls in Korea amongst high school and university students and ask them to rank different professions and jobs by the level of respect they have for them, teachers is always number one. If you're a teacher in Korea, you are a revered figure, right? And so education and an incredible work style commitment to work and to be part of the group. There are enormous social costs. Korean high school is very difficult. Taking your university entrance exams is very difficult. Korea has the highest teen suicide rate in the world. So the incredible pressure that's put on people, especially young people, to conform and to produce for the country is powerful. But that it's not natural resources. It's certainly not a friendly environment that they're in. Korea is a G20 country now. Korea has a GDP almost the same as Canada. As I said, there's in some ways it's more advanced than Canada, and in other ways it's less advanced. And the rural areas in particular are not as developed, but hard work, education combined with hard work. Here. That's true. What I find interesting is that was true 10 to 15 years ago. It is changing incredibly fast. So the social changes we've seen in Canada in the last 50 years are taking place in about 10 years in South Korea. So, yes, the family, the sense of obligation to family, to do what's right for the family, including doing what your parents or your grandparents tell you, is very, very powerful, right? Very, very powerful. Yes, sir.
North Korea was
South Korea has taken off, right? So it's not so much that North Korea has went backwards so quickly. It's just they were on a flatter trajectory. The South Koreans were on a sharper trajectory based on what I just said, the power of education and technology and really good industrial planning in South Korea. The other thing, the huge impact, was 1990, the end of the Soviet Union. Essentially, Russia doesn't support North Korea really at all. And when the Soviet Union disappeared, North Korea lost one of their two big brothers in terms of subsidizing them with oil and stuff like that. It's what's happened in Cuba and places like that too, right? Your system kind of works so long as somebody's pumping money in. And the Americans do it in lots of places around the world too, right? And when that money stops, it really slows down. And then they had huge famines. They had droughts in the 1990s. So a lot of things changed. Kim Il-sung died in 1993, and so his son took over, who never had the credibility that he did. But it's less about North Korea doing this. It's like North Korea's kind of done that, and South Korea's done this. That's what's really happened. Hi, there was a question. Right, Darcy?
I'm sorry, your opinion, why did China continue this support?
China continues to support. China still views the world in terms of blocks, right? And China would view North Korea as a buffer state between themselves and the South Koreans and the Japanese and the Americans. The Chinese don't want a unified Korea. The Chinese are like the North Koreans. They'd be happy with a unified Korea if it was North Korean, right? If the whole country was their ally. But they don't want them right on their face. There's a bit of a, what would you call it? Not gamesmanship, but a competitive environment there, too, about winning and losing. So even though China has said, and when Trump first started to make things happen, he was trying to put pressure on China to stop supporting North Korea. I'll be honest, at the time, I just thought it was very naive on his point. Like, there's no way China was going to do that. And these countries have been neighbors for hundreds, literally thousands of years, right? There's all kinds of baggage and history and long-term relationships. So China does not want to see North Korea. And at the same time, when North Korea becomes too big of a pain in the ass, I have jokingly said if North Korea fired one of those rockets and somebody by mistake, instead of going over to Japan, it went and hit something in an apartment building in China, I think China might go in and kind of clean it out, right? So long as my dog is biting your kids, it's a problem. When my dog bites my kids, I shoot it, right? So I think that's kind of where China sits here. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's tons of information flowing into the North now. The North Korean government, it's harder and harder to control it. It was CDs and CD-ROMs a few years ago, and then it was kind of like memory sticks that were being sent in, films. You know, in South Korea, churches will put like hot air balloons with like leaflets and send them when the day the winds blow into the North, send it over. Like, there's information coming in. The ability of any government to control the information flows is getting more and more difficult because of technology. So I personally believe the way to deal with North Korea would be to kind of leave it alone politically, but to open up relations and actually engage with them. And then I think the people of North Korea at some point, when they're powerful enough, would have a chance to kind of make some changes there. I don't believe that the North Korean regime will tolerate it. And the North Korean people have heard for 60 years that the Americans are the bad guys, too. So I don't want to call it brainwashing, but they're socialized to believe that the Americans are an imperialist power that want to take us over the same way that the Japanese did in the past. Yeah. Yeah, good question. Is there anyone is there anyone in the room who was a member of the armed forces in Korea? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I have met many of them in Lindsay and from Kawartha Lakes and Halliburton over the years. Oh, there was one last question. Somebody over here. Yes, sir. So South Korea has a national industrial strategy, and it works because the people in Korea believe in group effort. In Canada, if the government tried to impose a national industrial strategy, people would thumb their nose at them, basically, right? Say, buzz off, leave us alone, we're going to do what we want to do. But in Korea, it works. So they identified steel making in the first go-round and basic manufacturing. Then the next plan involves shipbuilding. And then they moved into automobiles. Remember the first kind of crappy Hyundai ponies that we got here? You go to the car, go and look at the new Korean cars today. They're as good as anything on the road, right? So automobiles, electronics was another explicit strategy. About 10 or 12 years ago, South Korea identified entertainment. So we don't see it here, but South Korea is, I think, the third largest exporter of TV programming and movies around the world. I think U.S. is number one. I think India is number two. I think if you go to anywhere in Asia and there's a bunch of people sitting around watching a soap opera at 2:00 in the afternoon, they're all Korean, right? They're all Korean in all these movies, music, K-pop music. And the most recent one that Korea has identified is education. And that's how guys like me got jobs there, because the national government is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars wanting to build South Korea. They have a declining enrollment. They had a declining birth rate, so they have a declining enrollment at the university. So their strategy is to bring in foreign students. And foreign to them is from anywhere in the world to fill those seats, right? Because the mayors of these small cities are getting antsy when they think they're going to lose their university because it creates a lot of jobs, right? So it's a national strategy. They look after, there's cronyism. You know, some of these rich families in Korea made tons of money because they started Samsung or they started LG or Hyundai. So, again, we wouldn't tolerate that. So it's not without its problems, but it for them it has worked. It has really worked. I've got two more quick ones, then I've got to stop before you guys are going to kick me out. So Cambodia, so... So this is Northeast Asia, Japan, Korea, China, Russia. This is Southeast Asia. So Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma is down here. So that's a three-hour flight, right? That'd be like going from here to Mexico. So that's that whole area which is its own hot spot, but it's a long way away from Korea. Last question. So I would argue, now there's no Korean Canadians in the room, so I can be very forthright here. One of the weaknesses of the Korean culture and attitude of this group is that they are kind of susceptible to kind of mythical figures, kind of demagogues. Remember Reverend Moon that had all, these were all Koreans, right? The largest Christian church, the largest Pentecostal Christian church, the largest Christian church in the world is in Seoul. It has over 100,000 members, right? So this kind of people kind of coming together behind some mythical figure, and Kim Il-sung, who was the original leader, started this. That this myth, he's almost like a god, right? And his picture is in every living room, and it has to be dusted, and if it falls on the ground, you'd get sent to the gulag. Like, it's true. It actually happens. So the positive side of the Korean character is that they work their tails off, and they succeed and have built a strong economy. The way that goes awry is that they can be led kind of down the garden path at the same time and are very deferential to figures of authority. So when, as a teacher, I could say no wrong. I could have told my students that 3 and 3 was 7, and none of them would have argued with me, right? It was kind of nice, actually, as a teacher. Sure was different from when I was the MP. In those days, I said 3 and 3 was 6, and people argued with me. So anyway, thank you for your attention.